Attorney General has released a statement. Late this afternoon, I met with the FBI Director James Comey. I received and accepted their unanimous recommendation that the thorough, years-long investigation be closed and no charges be brought.
But a key job of our new Prime Minister will be to ensure the continued success of the UK economy. Already, we can see that the forecasts of a disaster for sterling, for equities, and for interest rates have not been proven correct.
Based on the recommendation of General Nicholson, as well as Secretary Carter and Chairman Dunford, the United States will maintain approximately 8,400 troops in Afghanistan into next year through the end of my administration.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:08 and it is Thursday. It's July 7th, 2016. Welcome to another business day. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. We'll get right to the WGN market desk this morning. Most Asian stock benchmarks rose today after an upbeat U.S. economic report helped ease persistent investor concerns over Brexit-related global turmoil. Brexit-related turmoil is what we'll be discussing later in the broadcast as we talk to a Purdue University professor about how agriculture in the U.S. is going to be affected by all of this. Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 index slipped about 1% to 1,500.276 overnight as investors sought some safety in the yen, pushing it up against the dollar, making it the country's making that country's exports costlier overseas. Here's what we expect from the day ahead in the economy. The Labor Department reports on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week, and payroll processor ADP releases information on how many jobs private employers added in June. Today, Freddie Mac also reports on this week's average U.S. mortgage rates. A couple of big stories making news today. A group of advising the Food and Drug Administration on medical issues has abruptly dropped four experts from a panel on prescription painkillers after concerns emerged about pharmaceutical industry ties. Federal advisors are supposed to be vetted for financial ties that can influence their judgment. These were somehow missed. Also today, Samsung Electronics puts its second quarter operating income at $8.1 trillion. That is about $7 billion, the highest quarterly profit in more than 2 years. We'll continue to follow those stories and your money throughout the morning here on The Opening Bell and the latest market numbers as well. Well, the big indications of whether or not the economy can handle stress are the stress tests that have been put on banks lately. This was done in Great Britain just ahead of the Brexit vote. It is done regularly here in the United States. But is it enough? Hal Scott, a Harvard professor, is the author of a new book called Connectedness and Contagion from the MIT Press. He's with us this morning on The Opening Bell. Good morning, Mr. Scott. How are you?
Very good, Steve.
Well, I'm glad you're with us today because this, you know, your book is a very timely release in that this is concerns a lot of us. And many have said that these tests that the banks go through may not be enough. Is that something that you agree with?
Yes, I don't think we should just be confident if the banks pass these stress tests that everything is okay and that we'll survive a financial panic. I think for two reasons. Number one, the stress test can't anticipate everything that can happen. In fact, the European stress test didn't even stress for Brexit, which they knew was coming up. And secondly, stress tests only measure capital. And it is true that after the crisis, banks generally have more capital. But in a financial panic, which is sort of the story of my book, no amount of capital is enough. You need other weapons to fight the contagion that will break out in a panic where people are just taking their money out of banks or not giving their money back to banks. We need other weapons to deal with that.
Tell us what contagion is, for those who may not know.
Well, I'd say it's kind of a irrational run on the financial system, typified by the Depression, where there was a run on the banks. In the modern world, people aren't lined up there. They take their money out electronically, particularly institutions. And also in the modern world, it's not just about banks. It's about non-banks. In 2008, we had a run on the money market funds, for instance.
And so what would you like to see be the standard test for our financial system? What do you think needs to be done?
Well, I don't think there's any test, Steve. I think what we have to have are, if a contagion is sort of on the horizon or it breaks out, we need the central bank to provide adequate liquidity. We need the deposit insurance agencies like FDIC to increase their insurance. We need ways to provide guarantees for non-banks in a crisis, and ultimately we need to inject capital into failing banks. By the way, all these things that we did quite successfully in 2008 are now highly restricted because of the feeling in Congress in 2010 when Dodd-Frank was passed that all this was a bailout of Wall Street. And, of course, today every political candidate is against bailing out Wall Street. Now, under that heading, we've kind of restricted all these things we're actually going to need to do if we come into another crisis.
Al Scott, Harvard professor, bank stress tests is what we're talking about today in preventing financial crisis, the author of a new book called Connectedness and Contagion from the MIT Press. We'll continue our morning business conversation with Hal.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 518, our morning business conversation with Hal Scott, a Harvard professor who's written a new book called Connectedness and Contagion from the MIT Press. Professor Scott, we were talking before the break about some of these bank stress tests and other stuff. I'm interested to get your opinion on this notion of too big to fail, because we've been hearing over the last couple of months, every once in a while, one of these other big financial institutions has been declared not too big to fail. This whole notion of too big to fail, is it a joke?
I think it's a partial joke, Steve, not a complete joke. I think we don't, in principle, we don't want institutions to be rescued by the government, because that creates bad incentives for those institutions who know they can be rescued. They would take more risk. The question is, can we design a financial system to avoid that? And it's very difficult, particularly with extremely large banks. Now, we think we're on the road to doing it, but we're far from there. I think it's a concern that they are too big to fail, but making sure that we can allow them to fail without injecting public capital is a very difficult thing in reality, although everybody, would like to see that.
The Dodd-Frank Act of 2010 was designed to reform financial policies and prevent this financial crisis, another financial crisis like we saw in 2008. Do you think it's doing its job properly, or has it been watered down and changed too much?
It's not been watered down. I would say that, you know, the agencies that have implemented Dodd-Frank have done a good job. They've, been very, very tough on the banking system. The problem is, that I described before, is you can do a lot to try to prevent a crisis, but you also need to be sure that if it ever happens, despite your best efforts, that you're able to fight it. It's like you would tell people that they should take prevention against fires and, you know, do all sorts of things by having sprinklers in their house. But you wouldn't abolish fire departments because people did that, because it's still possible to have fires. So on the one hand, we strengthen the system to try to prevent crisis. And on the other hand, if crisis ever occurs, we've greatly weakened it.
And this goes back to this whole contagion effort, contagion aspect as well. What do you think is the answer there? I know we talked about the contagion, the idea of contagion and what it is. But what do you think needs to be done to sort of stop that in its tracks before it gets to the point where it's hurting the bigger financial system?
Well, you have to have three things in place, ideally. One is you have to have a strong lender of last resort, the Federal Reserve. They did that in 2008. Unfortunately, they're now restricted on what they can do, particularly for non-banks, which are very important. Number two, you have to have insurance, guarantees, like bank deposit insurance, but it needs to be increased in a crisis, and it needs to be extended beyond the banking system. We've also made that very difficult to do in Dodd-Frank. And third,
ultimately, we have to be prepared to inject capital in banks, and we did that with the TARP program. That is, of course, expired now, so we can't do that very easily. So those are the things, you know, time-tested ways of preventing or stopping contagion if it happens. But we're unfortunately not really able to do those things now.
With the TARP program specifically, would you like to see something in place where that can be done more easily, where it doesn't have to go through that whole congressional cycle? Would you like to have that as one of the tools in the tool chest?
Absolutely. By the way, Europe has that in their tool chest, and Japan has it in their tool chest. I would not like to allow that tool to be easily used, but you could have the whole tool out there. It could be totally designed, ideally pre-funded by the Congress, but I would give to the Congress the, you know, key. They would have to pass a joint resolution. You remember in 2008 what happened, or 2009, is that, you know, they couldn't pass TARP. The market went down the tubes. Paulson had come in there with what people said was a term sheet, a one-page piece of paper. And then, you know, within 2 days, they kind of filled out some details. But we've learned a lot since then. We could do a much better design. But, you know, the prudent thing to do is to have the tool in place, as you suggest, but have a high bar for actually using it.
Because as you mentioned there, a lot of damage happened in the time that it was first proposed, and by the time it was finally put in place, that's damage that might have lessened the impact of that 2008 meltdown, is it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're quite right, Stu.
Tell us about how the other countries, like you mentioned, Japan has this in their tool chest. What is the trigger there for putting this in place? Let's say if Japan was in some sort of financial meltdown.
Well, Japan actually trusts their agencies to do it. They have to get a special permission from the prime minister, but there's no vote in the parliament that would be required to trigger Japan's, TARP program. So they designed the whole thing. They've entrusted to their prime minister, ultimately, the power to trigger it.
You mentioned a word there that I think might actually be one of the things that's impacting what happens in the United States, and that is trust. Do you think that there is trust on all sides involved here, from the Congress to the executive branch to others who are involved, that each side of this is going to get it right and not do something for their own benefit?
Absolutely no trust, Dave. I mean, this isn't limited to financial matters, as our listeners are well aware. So the lack of trust makes this even more complicated here.
And so how do you get past that?
You don't, unfortunately. It would take a considerable change in American politics right now to get past this lack of trust between the Congress and the president. By the way, I don't think it's just because they happen to be of different parties. In recent history, even when the same party controlled both branches, we've seen a lack of trust between the two. The two have very different incentives. The congressmen want to get elected in, 2 years, and the president has a much longer horizon. So it's kind of wired into the system, this kind of disagreement as to what to do.
There are some that say that there are shenanigans going on in the financial sector that could be leading us to another financial crisis. Are you seeing anything in that concerns you, that the financial sector is doing again that they shouldn't be doing?
Well, I don't think right now it's any shenanigans in the financial sector. You know, what we did experience, and we're still experiencing to some extent, is the fallout from Brexit, that decision of the UK to leave the European Union. And markets, so they've calmed down considerably since the vote, are still a little uncertain about what the future is going to be there. And just yesterday we had some announcements about Italian banks being in trouble, and maybe they need to be recapitalized. So I think the whole situation with Brexit and Europe are troubling. But it's not about the banks fundamentally. It's about the political situation. Contagion can be triggered, Steve, by not just the financial system. As it could be triggered by anything. It could be triggered by Brexit. It could be triggered by terrorism. But whatever it's triggered by, we need to be able to, fight it if it occurs.
Harvard professor Hal Scott, the author of a new book called Connectedness and Contagion, Protecting the Financial System from Panics, from the MIT Press. It is out now. Professor, thank you for being with us on the opening bell, and a good discussion with you this morning.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 534. Britain's departure from the European Union would have little direct impact on U.S. agriculture trade, but could slow economic growth in states like Indiana and Illinois. This is according to Purdue University, agriculture economist. This morning, we're happy to have one of those on with us on the opening bell, Professor Mike Bolgi of Purdue University. Professor, thanks first for being with us on the opening bell today. I suppose the biggest question people are wondering is, what is the impact that we might see on agriculture for states like Illinois and Indiana?
Yeah, well, I think there are certainly some short-term implications of this, my own viewpoint is it's the longer-term implications that are really pretty critical and most important. Short-term, a lot of volatility in the markets, and so what we're suggesting is that people at least kind of watch the markets, maybe saying, stand back a little bit, don't get too caught up in really the gyrations that we might see out of this. The other short-term thing which is probably important to kind of recognize is that the direct impacts in terms of the UK is not a major player in the export markets for U.S. agriculture. And so in that context, we aren't as worried as we might be if this were happening in a country where they were a bigger potential customer. We are concerned about what's happening to the value of the dollar in this environment and the uncertainty that we see in the markets, and the rising value of the dollar, not relative to all currencies because of the flight to safety or the flight to security when there's a lot of volatility in the financial markets and the commodity markets. It does put our U.S. exports at a disadvantage. Those are probably the short-term issues that we're worried about.
Give our listeners who may not be aware a sense of just what our exports are to Great Britain in terms of agriculture, in terms of money, and in terms of size.
Yeah, well, the numbers that we have, and let me just take a second and pull them up in the files. And this is based on the work that a colleague of mine here at Purdue, Dr. Phil Abbott, has done. But let me just give you some specific numbers. In the U.S. In 15 exported about $8.3 billion of corn globally, and only less than 1% of that went to Great Britain. So it's really, 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 really pretty insignificant in that regard. And in the soybean market, it's about $18.9 billion of soybeans in terms of U.S. total worldwide exports. And again, in that case, only about 76 million of that went to Britain. In the overall export markets, in terms of U.S. total exports, about 133 billion, about 1.8 billion went to the UK. Mainly here we're talking about wine, nuts, fruits, vegetables, meat and dairy products, those types of things. And so I guess, wine actually is the one that probably in the more of the food product end of the value chain is the one that has the biggest dollar volume. So again, not major market positions there that we never like to lose market to anybody in any place, as any good company company or business would want to have, but not the major player that is, if they were, an Asian country, China, or those types of things.
So from a long-term standpoint, I guess the fear is that a lot of the contracts and other trade agreements with Europe as a whole will have to be redone. Is that where the fear and concern lies?
Yeah, so the real longer-term implications here are, I think, where we are really watching carefully. We just don't know what's going to happen. So there's kind of three dimensions of this, which we're really watching carefully. One is we do have some trade agreements that are in the process of being negotiated. The Pacific Trade Agreement has not yet been agreed to, and we've got the Atlantic Trade Agreement that was in negotiation. Certainly the Atlantic Trade Agreement is on hold now because we've got another issue. They have another issue that's much more important for them. In the EU and in Britain, they're not going to be worried about what to do in terms of trade agreements. They got to worry about this resolving this issue, and it's kind of put the whole issue of trade agreements, if you will, under suspect or on hold. And it's more broadly in that context. Just to put it in context, so we understand, agricultural exports are more important for the agricultural sector than for most sectors in the U.S., and exports account for only about 10-11% of total U.S. agricultural economic total activity of the U.S. economy, only about between 10-12% of what we produce here in the U.S. in terms of our entire U.S. economy goes into global markets. In the agricultural sector, it's closer to 20%, and for some products, it's well over that. It's 20, in fact, 22 to 24%. So we really are export dependent, and much more so than most other sectors of the U.S. economy. And the issue here is that if we have put this globalization movement, which has been occurring over the last 30, 40, 50 years, opening up markets, moving to more global trade, moving to making sure with WTO and then various other types of arrangements that we can continue to reduce the barriers to trade across the countries and across borders. If this is an indication that we're going to be moving or at least pausing in that move, then that makes us a little bit nervous. And when you put that on top of the same kind of discussion that appears to be happening here in the U.S., in the political arena at least, where we seem to be having much more discussion on we need to, that trade agreements aren't good, that we need to close markets, or we need to be more aggressive in how we negotiate these trade agreements. And that happens to actually be in the current political debate, kind of the argument of both the Republican and on the Republican and the Democratic side, that then makes one nervous about this whole issue of will we be able to continue to move to a more open trading economy, or will we move to some more restrictions and closing and focusing more on national issues and closing some borders and et cetera, and more restrictions in terms of whether what we export, and when we restrict what we export or restrict what we import, then we end up with particularly if we restrict imports and don't want a lot of product or even people come in, that then starts having other countries say, well, if you're going to do that, we're going to have to not let your stuff cross into our borders. And so the openness versus closeness kind of issue is a pretty important thing for the agricultural sector, not just in terms of product movement, in terms of agricultural products, but also in terms of technology. I mean, the technology that we have evolved here has a global market in the agricultural industry. And so the opportunity to move our seed and our fertilizer and our chemicals and our machinery and equipment and our new innovations. And so it does make one a little bit nervous about that, including the movement of people. A large part of our workforce here in the U.S. Comes from people who cross the border into the U.S. and work in our packing plants and work in our livestock operations. The immigrant labor is really significant to the agricultural sector, and so when we start disrupting those movements, it has a pretty significant impact on the sector. And then there is another side of this whole thing. And that is that if we start having this disruption results in a global economic slowdown generally, the European Union, for example, moving into a recessionary type of mode, which some people are talking about now. Let's don't forget that China is an export-driven economy. About 25% of their exports go to the European Union. If that slows down, now China doesn't have as much money that they could use to buy stuff from elsewhere, and they are a big customer of ours in the agricultural industry. So now we have slowdown in global economic growth, and when you get a slowdown in economic growth, even if you don't have restrictions on trade, slowdown in economic growth means that that you again have this slowdown in the opportunity to export products to the rest of the world. So these are things we're watching. We don't know what's going to happen, but those are probably the most important things to be watching as we think about how this whole issue affects U.S. agriculture. It's not so much the direct impact. It's all those indirect impacts, which actually may be the most important for the industry.
From West Lafayette, Indiana this morning in Purdue University, it's Mike Bolgi, a distinguished professor of agriculture economics at Purdue, on the subject of Brexit.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 549 on the WGN market desk this morning. The Dow futures up about 8 points. The S&P and NASDAQ futures are lower, just a little bit, though. We'll have more on the markets as we move through the morning. But first, let's find out what's happening in the commodities world. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. I've been telling listeners for 50 years there is one marketing rule that never fails. That rule is prices never go the same way forever. There is always a correction. And in the past month, have we ever seen that in the corn bean market? The early weather rally in June that has now completely disappeared, sending soybeans below $11 and sending corn below $4. Well, corn futures dropped another 2.4% to a 21-month low yesterday. That's the fifth session in a row that we have seen that market move lower. And soybeans also down on pressure from the good weather. So at the end of the day yesterday, soybeans did recover from their lows, ending down 10 3/4, and July corn ended down 7, while wheat ended down 1 1/4. Livestock, lean hog futures down to a one-month low yesterday. Traders selling the deferred hog contracts, thinking that maybe less expensive corn might motivate farmers to expand their herds. And so at the end of the day yesterday, we saw the October lean hog contract down $2.12, the August cattle contract down $1.30. Today is opening day of the I&I Old Time Farm Equipment Show in Penfield, Illinois. Max Armstrong will be spending a lot of time at that show. It starts today, runs through Sunday at Penfield, the first outdoor show, really, of the season. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
All right, you too, Orion. Thank you. A couple of other stories making news this morning. A big hospital merger making business news. Two Catholic hospital chains are merging to create the nation's third largest nonprofit health system with more than 100,000 employees in 7 states. Providence Health and Services of Irvine, California is merging with St. Joseph Health of Renton, Washington. to create Providence St. Joseph Health. The new entity has 50 hospitals in Alaska, California, Montana, New Mexico, Oregon, Texas, and Washington State. Snapchat's commitment to the ephemeral message was ephemeral. The popular visual messaging service is giving users a new way to save old snaps they shared with friends. A tool called Memories lets you save content on the app that was previously out in the air. This includes photos, videos, or montages, photo montages called Stories. You can later scroll through them or send them on to contacts. That's yet another way from step away from Snapchat's former fixation on snaps that vanish. That was part of the draw to Snapchat. While it's already possible to save snaps on your phone's camera roll, Memories let users actually save them privately within the app itself. Those are some of the stories that we'll be watching for you through the morning. We'll also be watching the markets, keeping our eye on your money as we move through the morning. And we will continue to follow some of the other business stories. And one other note, by the way, if you're a fan of Marvel Comics, there is a replacement for Iron Man. It's the new Iron Man, and apparently they've selected a black female teenager. It is the first for Marvel Comics. So writer, veteran writer Brian Michael Bendis says in an interview today that Tony Stark will step away from his superhero alter ego, and a new character named Riri Williams will assume the laser blasting role. So for you comic nuts today, that's what's happening in the comics world.